listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents The Myth of Redemptive Violence, the sermon by the Reverend Gene Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, February 25th, 2018.
Now, before I begin my message today, let me just confess that this sermon is a little bit half-baked. Now, that's not because I didn't have time or effort to bake it. It's because there are so many sources that I was turning to. And for those of you who are wide-read in theology, and I know there are quite a few of you, you will hear echoes of Walter Wink and Rob Bell and Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan and Diana Butler Bass, and I hardly slept this week. But let's begin here. How many of you have ever watched a Saturday morning cartoon? Me too. Any favorites? Anyone else? Tom and Jerry, that was my son's favorite. For me, Bugs Bunny. For my brother, The Roadrunner. And Caleb loved Tom and Jerry. And with apologies to the creators and artists who made them, we all know the plot of every single one. A bad guy does some bad stuff to a good guy. So the good guy does some bad stuff to the bad guy. The bad guy then retaliates and does some more bad stuff to the good guy. The good guy then retaliates and does some more and perhaps worse bad stuff to the bad guy. Eventually, the good guy wins because he takes his turn and does some more bad stuff to the bad guy before the bad guy can take his turn and do another bad thing to the good guy. Now, that is a silly window into one of the central things wrong with human culture. We have bought into the myth of redemptive violence. We have been brought up to believe that if someone does something wrong, violent, or unjust to us, we can make it right. We can redeem the whole situation by doing something wrong, violent, or unjust back to them. Check out most any action movie, Tom Cruise, Liam Neeson, or that one with Matt Damon, the Jason Bourne movies. The bad guy harms the good guy hits back, the bad guy hits back harder, and away we go. Until the final scene, when the good guy gets one in faster and harder and sends the bad guy packing. For now. But only for now. Because, of course, in this cycle of violence, nothing is ever solved. Which is why you and your children and I and my children could watch the same plot of cartoon mindlessly Saturday after Saturday, happily and mindlessly, and why these movies spin off into seemingly endless sequels. Exactly how many James Bond movies does the world require? Now, I don't mean to get all moralistic about what any of us finds mindlessly entertaining, but I do think Jason Bourne is a very big favorite in my family. Not for me, but for the rest. But I do think we should maybe pay attention to the pattern we've been indoctrinated into, because it's everywhere in our culture. Let's think about Twitter for just a moment. How many of you are on either Twitter or Facebook? How many of you have ever spent any time reading the comments section after someone has posted something the least bit controversial? If you've never done it, I invite you to do it one time, once. But don't spend a lot of time there because it will make you despair of humanity. How many of you have actually gotten, like me, a secret little thrill out of following somebody else's Twitter war? Well, a few of us will cop to it. It can be like watching a sort of cruel game of ping pong. The nastiness goes ponging back and forth and back and forth, escalating just a little bit every time. It's not just social media or pop culture. The myth of redemptive violence, the idea that if someone does something wrong, violent, or unjust, we can make it right and redeem the situation by doing something equally or more wrong, violent, or unjust back to them. This idea is woven into literature and art, and it is curled right at the heart of human history. In part, it is how some of us were parented, or some of us continue to parent. We yell at our children for yelling. We spank our children. We hit them to teach them that hitting is wrong. It's codified into the death penalty, a situation in which we try to teach people who kill people that killing people is wrong by killing someone. And all of this keeps the violence in circulation. It keeps the cycle moving farther and farther along. It's the story of the Hatfields and the McCoys, the Montagues and the Capulets. It's the story of England and France for 100 years in the 14th and 15th centuries. It's right at the heart. It's explicit in the insane idea that to stop bad guys with guns, we need to give more people guns. Perhaps we should put those guns in the hands of teachers, the ultimate good guys and gals in our culture. I had something shocking. This isn't in my script, but I have to share that yesterday I was working on my laptop, and my son borrowed my laptop last spring. So sometimes some things that are for him pop up in the side of my screen. And he had received an email, unrequested, inviting him to apply for a concealed carry permit because he's 18 and male. So it just arrived, because what a good idea to give more people guns. This story, this myth of the redemptive value of violence is deeply embedded in the human experience. It's embedded in our families, in our communities, in our politics, and of course, between nations. And when we are stuck in this cycle, believing that somehow, magically, this time, redemptive violence ponging back and forth will solve the problem, no one ever learns anything. I've watched it play out on the lacrosse field when the refs were not doing their job. The visiting team, the bad guys, started to play rough and dirty, using illegal checks and painful ones. And every single one of the boys on our team, every single one of the good guys, my kid included, did exactly what they had been coached to do. They hit back just as illegally and a little bit harder. And no one in the field or in the stands found this surprising or upsetting in the least. What else are you gonna do? It's only right. Stands to reason. The violence that day ended when one team got caught. Their player was sent off the field in disgrace. But it only ended for that day and until the next tournament, which was 2 weeks later. Perhaps you've witnessed the pattern up close, or even been caught up in it yourself. Maybe it's not something physically violent, but verbally and emotionally violent, between coworkers, or say, two ex-spouses who have been sending nastiness and verbal jabs back and forth. If years and years have gone over, and you're still stuck in the same rut, pause and ask yourself, what am I doing? What do I believe is going to happen when I behave this way? And who am I? What can I do to take the violence, hatred, or just simple nastiness out of circulation? Because otherwise it will go on and on, ponging back and forth. This myth has, of course, also been legitimated by religion. And I don't just mean other people's religion, I mean ours. In the first instance, we hear it in the Hebrew scripture, this concept of an eye for an eye. It's given as part of the Mosaic law, and it was used in the Israelites' justice system. The principle is that the punishment must balance the crime, and there should be a just penalty for every evil action. In Exodus, we read, if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. The thing to remember, which we often forget, is that this law was given to try to make justice equitable and to prevent excessive retribution and an escalation of the cycle of violence. It was meant to cool things down. The law of an eye for an eye seems not to have been followed literally. We don't ever read a story of someone actually losing an eye in the scripture. Capital crimes were repaid with execution, but most other crimes were repaid with payment in goods. If you injured a man's hand so that he could not work, you compensated that man for his lost wages. The phrase an eye for an eye appears in passages about cases before a civil authority, like a judge. It was meant as a guiding principle for lawgivers and judges. It was never meant to be used to justify vigilantism or settling grievances personally on an individual level. But rather than acting to put the brakes on escalating cycles of violence, that language has been bred in our bones to mean just the opposite. And we've interpreted it in some kind of literal way that I must get my own back. It feels fair and balanced, even moral and right. The problem is that humans so often don't stop at this even exchange. This idea that returning violence for violence is redemptive has been used to explain even the crucifixion. If you have ever heard someone say that God needed to kill God's son because then God could be happy, that Jesus needed to die so that God could be reconciled to humanity and be at peace, that is the myth of redemptive violence codified at the core of our tradition. A God who needs violence to make things right is a God that we have created in our own image to stay stuck in the myth of redemptive violence, just like everybody else. That is an idea of God that cannot help us. We need to leave that idea behind. When people tell you this story of the cross, that God needed to commit violence so that violence could continue, even when they point out that it has an official theological name, substitutionary atonement, and a long history in the church, they are actually telling you a story that perpetuates the myth. There is another, and I think a better way, of understanding the cross. The cross can be the thing that calls out the myth of redemptive violence. It is not about perpetuating the violence. It's about calling for an end to it. Jesus goes willingly to the cross without retaliating. Jesus goes to the cross to give the lie to the same old patterns of, you do this to me, I'll do that to you. It offers us a glimpse into another way of understanding what it means to be human and to be created in the image of God. Jesus called the crowd with his disciples, and he said to them, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. You and I and every other person who wants to follow Jesus has been invited into an imitation of Christ which includes picking up our cross. Well, that's frightening, and I don't want to. And given that Mark's first readers were living through both internal dissension within their group and the destruction of Jerusalem at the hands of the Romans, we are not wrong to be a little bit rattled by this language. What would it look like to take up our cross in our modern context? We do have some good examples of how it can be done. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, and Nelson Mandela. Mandela was released after 27 years of unjust imprisonment in apartheid South Africa. And once he was elected to the presidency in 1994, he could have led the whole country into a new cycle of violence, returning to the white population evil for every evil done to the black population for generations. He could have done that. Many would have applauded him. Many would have joined him. Instead, he and his party did something quite miraculous. They stepped out of the cycle of redemptive violence and set up truth and reconciliation committees to give the oppressed a voice, to tell the oppressor the truth of what they had done, and to give everyone a human way to move forward into a new future together. Now, it's easy to over-sentimentalize the truth and reconciliation effort. It was long and painful and imperfect. But it was an effort to give up the lie that perpetuating the cycle of violence would somehow redeem or fix what had gone before. Instead, it offered honesty, truth, and care for survivors. Now, just as a side note, as we think about suffering, there's a long history of the way we've talked about suffering in Christianity that is actually quite destructive. We are not called to suffer just for the sake of suffering. God does not like us better when we suffer. We don't have to seek suffering. It is part of the human condition. And we are not called to give our lives for just anything. It's important to say that this text has been used against people. The phrase, "Well, that's just your cross to bear," has been used to keep people who are oppressed in their situation of oppression. It's been used specifically to keep women trapped in situations of violence and domestic abuse. It's been used to keep people who are economically oppressed, oppressed. It was even used as part of the language of justification for chattel slavery. But that is not what this means. In the same way that Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King set aside their own lives for something larger, we are called to lose our egos, to surrender our ideas of where our worth comes from, to let go of our pride, and in return, gain our whole souls. We are called to lose and gain for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of God's realm of love and peace, which has come near in the life and teaching of Jesus. Not just because someone else would like to see us suffer. There is a difference, and we are allowed to step away and get help. Martin Luther King gave his life to the cause of justice. Nelson Mandela endured years of privation and hardship and imprisonment. And they turned to reconciliation rather than redemptive violence for the sake of God's reign of love on earth. As we move through this holy season of Lent, I invite all of us to pay attention to the myth of redemptive violence that is around us all the time. Pay attention to ways it may have seeped into relationships that you are part of, at work, within your family, your extended family, your extended connections online, the political organizations you belong to. And then look at the cross and ask yourself, is there a new way of being human? Can we do this in a new way? Can I let go of my desire to hit back and imagine a new way of being human? I saw this played out in a rather unexpected example. I don't know if any of you follow the actress and comedian Sarah Silverman. She had this really beautiful Twitter exchange. She's a very funny, rather caustic. It's very, quite R-rated, so be prepared. Comedian. She's very funny. She's got a rapier wit. And she was in a Twitter exchange with someone we would call a troll, was really, really rude to her. I mean, just nasty. And she answered back kindly. And he was really, really nasty back. And again, she answered back softly. And finally, he answered back a little bit more softly. And so she answered back. And the whole thing de-escalated until they came to a point of having a respectful exchange of ideas. They didn't agree necessarily, but they had reached a place where they could see that there was overlap in their ideas, overlap in their desires to be a good human person on the earth, and that beneath their differences, there was the unity of both being citizens of this country, of both being people. It doesn't always go that way. Sometimes real suffering is involved in being the one to break the cycle of violence, to be the one who steps out of the game of back and forth. Sometimes it will feel like losing. If you and an ex-spouse, for instance, have been in a back and forth, jabbing each other for years and years, and the kids come back after a weekend of being with the other spouse, and the other spouse has filled them with nasty ideas and lies about you, you have a choice. You can do the same thing back. You can talk about your ex-spouse in the same way that your ex-spouse is talking about you. You can mend fences with your kids by trying to get them back on your side. Or you can choose to put down the verbal sword and decide never again to be part of that back and forth. And for a moment, it will feel like losing. You can put down the verbal sword with that uncle who knows just how to get under your skin at Thanksgiving dinner. The one who may not even believe the things they say, but they really just like to push your buttons. It might be a coworker or a neighbor who just acts like sandpaper against your heart. What would it take to drop your retaliation? Even if your retaliation is only a silent one, eating away at your own heart that no one else really knows about, what would it mean to drop the storyline of retribution and release the pain instead of keeping it in circulation in the economy of redemptive violence? My own understanding of all of this, as I said, is still only half-baked, this new way of being. I think it will feel lonely sometimes, and it does feel lonely sometimes. But we are not left alone. We are surrounded by that great cloud of witnesses that have gone on before us. And we are surrounded by the body of Christ in this place. Perhaps this is our call to discipleship, the path to gaining our lives, our souls made whole and holy, joyful and free. And let the church say,